Hello, ahlan wa sahlan, and welcome to another episode of Arab Voices, a syndicated radio talk show that airs on dozens of radio stations in the US and Europe since 2002. This is Saeed, executive producer and host of Arab Voices. During this episode of Arab Voices, episode number 1201, I will have three segments. First, we will listen to the Electronic Intifada newscast, a summary of the latest developments in occupied Palestine, including the ongoing Israeli genocide in the Gaza Strip. During the second segment, I will air a portion of an interview Democracy Now! Conducted with Yanis Varoufakis, former finance minister of Greece and author of several books, about President Trump's so-called Board of Peace. After that, I will air a segment from Double Down News titled The Palestinian Genocide, The Ultimate Evidence, by former UNRWA chief spokesman Chris Gunness. Let's begin with the Electronic Intifada newscast, a summary of the latest developments in occupied Palestine, presented by Noura Burrows-Friedman, associate editor at the Electronic Intifada.
This is the Electronic Intifada newscast. I'm Noura Burrows-Friedman, associate editor at the Electronic Intifada. It's day 839 of Israel's genocide in Gaza. Here's a brief summary of some of the latest developments this week in Palestine. Israel continues to kill and injure Palestinians across the Gaza Strip, while the Israeli blockade remains firmly in place despite more than 100 days since the so-called ceasefire was agreed upon in October 2025. On Wednesday, 11 Palestinians were killed and 6 were injured in a series of attacks on Gaza, including an airstrike targeting a vehicle carrying 3 journalists, all of whom were killed. Al Jazeera reported that Anas Ghunem, Abdul Rauf, and Shaath Mohammed Keshta were documenting developments on the ground in central Gaza near the so-called Netzarim corridor when an Israeli strike hit the car. A 4th person was also killed in the attack, an Al Jazeera team on the ground reported. Video footage by reporter Osama Kahlout showed the bombed-out vehicle by the roadside, smoke still rising from the wreckage. The reporters worked for the Egyptian Committee for Gaza Relief, which supervises Egypt's relief work in Gaza, and were filming a newly established displacement camp. Israeli Army Radio, citing an Israeli security source, said that the Israeli Air Force had targeted a vehicle in central Gaza, claiming that its occupants were using a drone to collect intelligence on army forces. The Gaza Government Media Office said that as of Wednesday, the number of reporters and media workers killed since the beginning of the genocide has now risen to 260. 5 other Palestinians were killed across Gaza on Wednesday, according to the Gaza Health Ministry, including in an Israeli attack in central Gaza, where 3 Palestinians, including a child, were killed in eastern Deir al-Balah. And in southern Gaza, a 13-year-old child, Motassem al-Sharafi, was shot and killed by Israeli soldiers. Citing hospital staff, the Associated Press reported that the child was shot while collecting firewood in the eastern town of Bani Suhaila. Reporter Samer Al-Boji recorded footage of Mutassim's family grieving over his body, their hands and faces covered in their child's blood. On Monday, January 19th, a 17-year-old boy, Hussein Abu Sabla, was shot and killed by Israeli soldiers in eastern Khan Yunis. Israeli soldiers shot and injured several children this week. Faris Afanna, the director of emergency and medical services in Gaza, reported that a 14-year-old girl was among a group of people wounded by random Israeli sniper fire that targeted tents for displaced families in northern Gaza on Tuesday. Afanna said that emergency crews operating with severely limited capacity and damaged ambulances transported 4 injured people using the only functioning emergency vehicle in the north, including 2 in critical condition from the Beit Lahia area, and later evacuated 2 more overnight, one of them, the 14-year-old girl, to hospitals in Gaza City. Israeli gunfire injured a Palestinian child sheltering at the Halawa School in Jabalia in northern Gaza on January 17th. Wafa News Agency said that the attack coincided with airstrikes east of Gaza City, as well as shelling of Deir al-Balah and Al-Burej refugee camp. Gunfire from Israeli military vehicles also resumed east of Khan Yunis and north of Rafah. In a statement on the passing of 100 days since the so-called ceasefire was agreed upon, The Gaza government media office affirmed on Tuesday that Israel has violated the agreement approximately 1,300 times and that nearly 500 Palestinians have been killed. Among the violations were 430 shootings, 66 incursions by vehicles into neighborhoods and residential areas, 604 bombings and targeted attacks, and 200 demolitions of houses and various buildings. Israel's compliance rate for the amount of aid and commercial trucks is around just 43%. Only 13% of the necessary amount of fuel trucks have entered Gaza to operate bakeries, vehicles, and generators. At least two children have died due to hypothermia as Israel's blockade on proper shelters and caravans remains in place, with no end in sight. Last week, the Gaza government media office reported that 127,000 of the 135,000 tents in displacement camps have been rendered unusable because of the recent extreme weather. Al Jazeera's Tarek Abu Azoum told the network on Monday that, quote, hundreds of thousands of displaced families are still living in torn tents and roofless homes exposed to the rain and cold and the freezing nights. On January 20th, a seven-month-old child, Shatha Abu Jarad, died due to the severe drop in temperatures in Gaza, according to Mahmoud Basal, the spokesperson for the Palestinian Civil Defense. Basal warned that thousands of children remain at serious risk as the Israeli occupation, backed by the United States, continues to block the entry of caravans, safe shelters, heating supplies, and sustainable construction materials, forcing families to survive winter inside torn tents with no protection. Basal said that these deaths are preventable and called for immediate international action before more children lose their lives. On January 17th, a four-week-old infant, Aisha Ayesh Al-Agha, died from hypothermia in Khan Yunis. As Israel continued its attacks across Gaza, the Israeli army dropped leaflets onto the tents of dozens of displaced families in Bani Suhaila, east of Khan Yunis, earlier this week, ordering Palestinians to leave. A resident from the Bani Suhaila area said that the expulsion orders impact at least 70 families living in tents and homes, some of which are partially damaged. Quote, we have fled the area and relocated westward. It is maybe the fourth or fifth time the occupation expanded the yellow line since last month, the man told the Reuters news agency by phone from Khan Yunis. Each time they move it around 120 to 150 meters inside the Palestinian-controlled territory, swallowing more land, he said. Ismail Al-Tawabta, director of the Gaza government media office, told Reuters that the Israeli military had expanded the area under its control in eastern Khan Yunis five times since the ceasefire, forcing the displacement of at least 9,000 people. Quote, on Monday, January 19th, 2026, the Israeli occupation forces dropped warning leaflets demanding the forced evacuation of the Bani Suhaila area in eastern Khan Yunis governorate, in a measure that falls within a policy of intimidation and pressure on civilians, the Webta said. Meanwhile, the research agency Forensic Architecture released a detailed analysis of Israel's military movements in Rafah, in southern Gaza, which suggests that Israel is, quote, beginning to build infrastructure which may be used to house Palestinians and effectively contain them in an area under full Israeli military control. Forensic Architecture says that the Israeli military is currently busy razing a strategic area of Rafah, compacting the ground and clearing rubble in a way that could be in preparation for construction of a so-called humanitarian city, or, as we've reported before, concentration camps. The area of interest, the group says, quote, is half a kilometer into Israel's area of control, bound by two military corridors and near the camp of the Israeli-affiliated Counter-Terrorism Strike Force, several military outposts, and the former Gaza Humanitarian Foundation sites. This environment suggests supervision and control rather than humanitarianism, Forensic Architecture said. Euromed Human Rights Monitor, in a report released earlier this month, warned that the so-called Green City Plan, quote, entrenches a reality of prolonged, unlawful control, de facto annexation of land by force, and the imposition of unlawful forms of collective confinement of civilians in clear violation of international law and the Palestinian people's right to self-determination. The area designated for the new city is currently under Israeli military control and hosts armed militias created by Israel, militias that have been proven to be involved in killings, intimidation, and theft against Palestinians, raising serious questions about their role in the emerging landscape being prepared in the area, Euromed says. In early December, details were disclosed regarding the U.S. plan for the Gaza Strip developed through the U.S. Civil Military Coordination Center. The plan is based on establishing a rigid system of geographic segregation that divides Gaza into population blocks and closed military zones. Under this framework, more than half of the Gaza Strip is effectively placed within a closed military zone under direct Israeli army control, where strict systems of surveillance and military administration are imposed, Euromed states. A coercive environment is enforced, characterized by restrictions on movement, control over aid and essential services, and deprivation of a range of fundamental rights. These measures are used as pressure tools to push residents to leave their original places of residence and forcibly relocate to designated areas labeled safe within the closed military zone without being granted any genuine choice to remain or to return home, the group says. Turning to the occupied West Bank, Israeli forces shot and killed a child, 15-year-old Mohammed Saed Sami Nassan, in the village of Al-Mugayr on January 16th. Defense for Children International Palestine reports that Mohammed was shot in the chest by Israeli soldiers while Palestinian worshippers were exiting the Eastern Mosque in the village. The Israeli forces shot tear gas canisters and stun grenades as worshippers exited the mosque after noon prayers. Palestinian youth threw stones toward the soldiers, and the soldiers, who were on foot, opened fire and shot Mohammed in the chest from no more than 20 meters, or about 65 feet, away. Mohammed was transported in a private vehicle first to the health center in Abu Falah, then to the Ramallah Medical Complex, where he was pronounced dead on arrival. Israeli forces had been routinely harassing Palestinian worshippers on Fridays at the Eastern Mosque in Al-Mugayr for weeks. Thousands of residents of the village joined a funeral procession for Mohammed on Saturday. In an escalation of routine attacks on UNRWA, the United Nations Agency for Palestine Refugees, Israeli forces used bulldozers and other heavy machinery to destroy the UNRWA headquarters in the Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood of occupied East Jerusalem on Tuesday. Israeli forces, accompanied by bulldozers, raided the UNRWA headquarters and began demolishing structures inside the compound, in the presence and under the supervision of Israeli National Security Minister Itamar Ben-Gvir. In an explicit expression of political support for the destruction and undermining of a UN organization, Ben-Gvir described the events as, quote, a historic day, a day of celebration, and a day of great importance for governing Jerusalem for many years to come, Euromed Human Rights Monitor said. Ben-Gvir called UNRWA, quote, supporters of terrorism, saying that, quote, today they are being expelled from here along with everything they built. This is what will happen to anyone who supports terrorism. The demolition and accompanying statements constitute a deliberate attempt to recast UNRWA from a UN agency protected by international immunity into an enemy stripped of legitimacy through accusations of terrorism, Euromed stated. Quote, this paves the way for normalizing attacks against the agency and any independent international presence, while testing the limits of international deterrence and seeking to establish a precedent that UN immunity can be violated without consequence. In Jerusalem, the act carries an explicit assertion of sovereignty aimed at entrenching de facto annexation by eliminating any UN presence that reminds the world of the city's status as occupied territory and of the refugee issue and their rights. Roland Friedrich, the agency's West Bank director, said UNRWA received word that demolition crews and police arrived at their East Jerusalem headquarters earlier on Tuesday. Staff have not operated out of the facility for almost a year out of safety concerns, but Israeli forces confiscated devices and forced out private security guards protecting the facility, according to a report by the Associated Press. Quote, what we saw today is the culmination of 2 years of incitement and measures against UNRWA in East Jerusalem, Friedrich said. UNRWA Chief Philippe Lazzarini said the attack came, quote, in the wake of other steps taken by Israeli authorities to erase the Palestine refugee identity. He also warned that what happens today to UNRWA will happen tomorrow to any other international organization or diplomatic mission anywhere in the world. An Israeli politician, Yulia Malinovsky, posed for a photo in front of the rubble of UNRWA's headquarters, celebrating and bragging about its demolition. Malinovsky, born in Ukraine, is a member of Avigdor Lieberman's far-right Yisrael Beiteinu party and the co-author of the 2024 bill that designated the Agency for Palestine Refugees as, quote, a terrorist organization. Later on Tuesday, Israeli forces fired tear gas at a Palestinian trade school in a second targeting of a UN facility in occupied East Jerusalem, Al Jazeera noted. The attack on the UNRWA compound followed last week's raid on and forced closure of the agency's oldest health clinic inside the Old City of Jerusalem last week. Israeli forces are planning to cut water and electricity services to all UNRWA locations across Palestine. Likud Minister Eli Cohen said he sent formal requests to the power and water companies, ordering them to carry out the shutdown. Meanwhile, Israeli settlers rampaged the small Palestinian Bedouin village of Hirbet Chalat al-Sidra, northeast of Jerusalem, on January 18th. Video footage shows homes and vehicles bursting into flames at night. Several Palestinians were injured in the attack. And in a report for the Electronic Intifada, journalist Zena Tahan investigated plans for a new wall that the Israeli military is building deep inside the occupied West Bank. The wall, which is 22 kilometers long and 50 meters wide, includes an off-limits military-only road, quote, a project that will cut Palestinian landowners off from millions of square meters of their lands, displace Palestinian farming communities whose buildings will be demolished, and further sever movement between parts of the northern occupied West Bank. Tahan adds that, quote, in late November and early December 2025, Israeli forces began issuing dozens of demolition orders for homes, farms, greenhouses, livestock pens, water networks, and other structures along the planned route of the new segment of the wall in northern Jordan Valley. Countless Palestinians and their families living off these lands, whether landowners or employed workers, will be severely affected. Abdullah Abu Rahmeh, Director General of the Popular Action Department at the Wall and Settlement Resistance Commission, told the Electronic Intifada that, quote, the wall will isolate large swaths of privately owned, very fertile land. We are talking about some 190 to 200 square kilometers of land that will end up on the other side of the wall. For much more, read Zena Tahan's report, New Wall Threatens Thousands of Palestinian Families, on electronicintifada.net. As we reported a few weeks ago, the Israeli military announced plans to demolish a children's soccer field in the Aida refugee camp in Bethlehem in the occupied West Bank. A global support campaign paired with political pressure on international professional football figures this week forced the Israelis to suspend the demolition. Beloved children's television entertainer Ms. Rachel lent her support to the children in Aida camp, speaking with them recently and hearing their stories about their fight to save their field and how they deserve to play and be safe.
It's Miss Rachel! I'm so happy to see you in your beautiful soccer field! We are going to do everything we can to help save the field and that every child has the right to play soccer and that you deserve to have your wonderful field.
واحنا ما بدنا يهدموا ملعبنا وبدنا نلعب بامان لان هذا حلمنا
شكرا انك تضامنتي معنا احنا بنحبك كثير
لما شفتك واقفه معنا شعرت اننا مش لحالنا واحنا بنحب نوصل صوتنا لكل العالم
والملعب كثير مهم لنا لانه بنلاقي فيه اصدقائنا اللي بنحبهم وبنلعب معهم
شكرا انك واقفه معنا
We are so sad about what's happening in the field and what's happening in the camp. Thank you for supporting us and standing with us. And thank you so much. We love you.
I am so proud to be one of the people supporting you. And I know we've heard from some really, really big things are happening. And I really believe in my heart that the field will be saved. Anna Behebek.
Ms. Rachel stated on her Instagram, along with that video, quote, it was an honor to listen to them and hear how much it means to them that the world is rallying around them. The people hear them and the people know what is right and what is wrong. Taking joy from kids is wrong. Dehumanizing kids is wrong. Saying some kids get to play and some don't is wrong. Listen to the children. On Tuesday, it was reported that the president of FIFA, the International Soccer Federation, along with his European counterpart, intervened, suspending the field's demolition at least for the time being, with the final decision now resting with the Israeli government. Mohamed Abu Sror, the director of the youth center at the Aida pitch, told The Athletic that, quote, "This is a huge success for the campaign, but we are still concerned about what could be the final political decision of the matter. We still haven't received official confirmation from the army." Here is Mohamed Abu Sror on Tuesday.
I think it is just news till now. We did not have any official papers or decisions that reached us through our lawyer or through any letter from the FIFA or the European Federation for Football, the UEFA. I would say that we will be so happy if this intervention stop demolishing our playground. Our campaign would continue. We will continue our campaign to stop demolishing our playground. But till now, we are asking the FIFA or the UEFA to send us an official letter that the Israeli occupation would freeze or stop demolishing our playground.
Following the news that the soccer field would not be demolished, Ms. Rachel posted a follow-up video for the kids in Aida camp.
You saved the soccer field. I want to say the biggest congratulations ever to the kids at Aida camp and the grown-ups there. They got this petition going. They got 350,000 signatures. They created a challenge for people to do with 10 kick-ups or something. I'm sorry, I'm not the best at sports, but I know so many people commented, shared, signed the petition. When people come together, they can make amazing things happen because we all know what's right and wrong. And why would you destroy something that means so much to kids who have been through so much already? It just doesn't make any sense. And we all know it doesn't make sense. And we all came together. So everyone coming together caused FIFA and UEFA to intervene. And the Israeli government is now not going to destroy the soccer field. I'm just so proud of everyone. And the kids, you did it, you did it, you did it. I'm so proud of you. And it was so wonderful meeting you the other day on the Zoom call.
That was Miss Rachel. It is certainly good news for Aida camp and its children. But as our colleague Abu Bakr Abed commented, Palestinians in Gaza have been screaming at the top of their lungs to the same sports bodies to take any boycott actions against Israeli teams and to stop the annihilation of the people in Gaza, including more than 800 athletes and the destruction of hundreds of sports facilities. They have so far been met with silence. The Israeli human rights group B'Tselem released a new report this week titled Living Hell, which further documents the rampant abuse and torture of Palestinians inside Israeli prison camps. B'Tselem says, quote, "Israeli prisons continue to function as a network of torture camps for Palestinians, with the systematic abuse even more extensive than before. This includes physical and psychological abuse, inhumane conditions, deliberate starvation, and denial of medical care, all of which has led to numerous deaths. Some witnesses also described undergoing or witnessing sexual violence and abuse. The transformation of prisons into a network of torture camps is part of the Israeli regime's coordinated onslaught on Palestinian society, aimed at dismantling the Palestinian collective. Some of the report's findings detail the use by Israeli prison guards and doctors of extremely graphic sexual torture with objects and dogs, as well as psychological violence. We've published many features in the last week, but we wanted to highlight Winter Strikes with a Vengeance by Fida Al-Kadra, writing from Gaza. In a crammed tent, flooded with water and torn by the wind, by the seaside in Mawasi, Khan Yunis, Yad Abu Jamia, 49, is trying to support his and his son's family, a total of 14 people, Al-Kadra writes. Around him, tents sit cheek by cheek as displaced families face the bitter winter cold with no proper shelter, while rain and sewage flood their homes, creating harsh and unsanitary living conditions. Abu Jamia and his family were displaced from the Alzana area on the eastern side of Khan Yunis. In fact, he told the Electronic Intifada that since the beginning of Israel's genocide in Gaza, they had been displaced more than 20 times. Every time we took this dilapidated tent with us, for a year and a half, we have been trying to repair it and keep it standing. During a recent cold spell, when a storm hit Gaza, the tent collapsed. Quote, the tent was uprooted and the fabric torn apart. I received 3 nylon sheets from UNRWA and built a new tent in preparation for winter weather, but rainwater flooded it while we were sleeping. The family sought shelter in a neighbor's tent. The next morning, we tried to fix what was ruined, he said. All around him, the family's possessions, mattresses, and clothes were spread out on the beach to dry. They had managed to repair some tears in the tent, but it was ad hoc work. They need help as winter deepens, Abu Jimia said. That, however, is yet to come. Gaza's 2 million people need assistance to provide decent shelters as winter deepens. Already, several people, among them children and at least 4 babies, have died as a result of cold weather and inadequate shelters. But international organizations are themselves dependent on Israel to open crossings, and Israel continues to block or delay the delivery of aid and humanitarian goods, including tents. Even the UK was moved to protest in December that tents it had supplied were delayed for over a year. Those are excerpts from Winter Strikes with a Vengeance by Fida Al-Kedra, writing from Gaza on electronicintifada.net. And now, as we always do, we wanted to highlight people expressing joy, determination, and resilience across Palestine and around the world. In Gaza, a boy who goes by Ahmed the Little Farmer, along with his cat Simba, make videos showing the care and cultivation of plants despite constant displacement and attacks. Earlier this month, Ahmed and his cat were happy to find a new gardening tool. Ahmed says, quote, I'm Ahmed the Little Farmer with my friend Simba. I want to show you something I've been looking for a long time, and I finally found it, a watering can. What do you think? Is it nice or not? I'm sure my plants will be very happy with it. That's Ahmed in Gaza. You can follow him on Instagram at Ahmed Little Farmer. And that's it for the news roundup. As always, go to electronicintifada.net for much more, especially to read our new features by our brave writers in Gaza. You've been listening to the Electronic Intifada's newscast. I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman. Want to hear more? Check out our live stream with interviews, reports, and analysis, along with print articles, podcasts, and more at electronicintifada.net. Produced by Nora Barrows-Friedman, Tamara Nassar, and Pierre Loisel.
You're listening to Arab Voices, a syndicated radio talk show on dozens of radio stations in the U.S. and Europe since 2002. This is Saeed, executive producer and host of Arab Voices. While apartheid Israel continues its genocide on the Palestinian people in Gaza with ongoing daily killings and destruction, President Trump announced what he labeled Board of Peace, supposedly to reconstruct the destroyed Gaza Strip, and formed a group to the so-called Board of Peace to determine its political future. But none of those figures are Palestinians. He invited Israeli war criminal Benjamin Netanyahu, who is wanted by the International Criminal Court, for committing the ongoing current genocide in the Gaza Strip. Do I need to mention the other names of those who are now serving on that board? I think knowing that the war criminal who is responsible for the genocide is on the so-called Board of Peace tells you everything you wanted to know about this board. Let that sink in for a moment. Amy Goodman and Nermeen Sheikh at Democracy Now! Conducted an interview with Yanis Varoufakis, former finance minister of Greece and author of several books, about President Trump's so-called Board of Peace and threat to democratic world order. That interview was conducted on January 22, 2026, and I'm going to share a portion of that interview on the so-called Board of Peace. Let's listen in.
And Yanis, already before today's developments, you'd called the Board of Peace, quote, one of the most despicable developments in your lifetime. So if you could explain what your sense is now, given that we know more about the contours of this board, in particular, the fact that the charter itself made no mention of Gaza, though it was supposed to be a Board of Peace for Gaza.
Well, when I first heard about the Board of Gaza months ago, it made me think that, you know, this is something that Philip K. Dick would invent, part of science fiction, if he was on really bad drugs. The reason why it is a monstrous idea is because, think about it, what he initially proposed, and this is still going on, is that a private company, headed by him for life, will annex the occupied land of Gaza. And interestingly, the Europeans, they went along with that because they thought it was only about Gaza. But it wasn't. They were wrong. It was much bigger than that. It was all about, as we now see, replacing the international order that came out of 1945, the carnage of the Second World War, the Holocaust, and so on. Look, the United Nations undoubtedly has proven itself particularly weak. He said so, didn't he? We heard him say, oh, they haven't sorted out any wars. Well, there's a reason for that, because people like him keep vetoing any serious peace proposal at the level of the Security Council. But the whole point of what he's doing is essentially to create an unholy alliance of big business. This is what the tech lords, you know, Peter Thiel, various members of this cabal that were with him during his inauguration. The second integration. This is a new ideology, the ideology of corporations resembling, if you want to go back centuries ago, you know, the Dutch East India Company or the British East India Company. That monstrous, how shall I put it, nightmare is now coming back in very flimsy terms with a charter which is not worth the paper it's written on. But this is the whole intention. This is where we're being pushed.
And Yanis, let's just talk about who is on this the executive committee of this board. It includes, of course, Trump's son-in-law, Jared Kushner, Secretary of State Marco Rubio, as well as the former British Prime Minister, Tony Blair. Now, the French president, Emmanuel Macron, refused to join, warning that it could undermine the United Nations. But Trump will not only serve as the board's chair indefinitely, he will also have veto power over all the board's decisions. I mean, what do you think that means, especially in light of critics like yourself saying that this might actually be an organization that supersedes the United Nations, or in fact makes the UN entirely redundant?
Well, this is not a matter of interpretation. I mean, it's what Trump wants. It's what he says he wants to do. He says, okay, well, maybe we can keep the United Nations as a rubber stamp. After all, he did push through his proposal of this Board of Peace for Gaza through the Security Council with the complicity of the French and the British, who are now realizing that this is not just about, you know, brown people in the developing world. It's not just about the Palestinians, whom they themselves condemned to genocide. It's about them as well. So they're beginning to understand that they're getting their comeuppance. But, you know, when President Macron, for instance, you mentioned that, says, oh, but, you know, your Board of Peace is going to undermine the United Nations. No, where was President Macron when Israel was effectively wiping the floor clean with the Charter of the United Nations, with the decisions of the International Court of Justice, ordering Israel to withdraw from occupied territories? The answer is, people like President Macron and Prime Minister Keir Starmer of Britain and Friedrich Merz, the Chancellor of Germany, were aiding and abetting this trashing of the United Nations. So in a sense, Trump has all his work done for him by placid European centrists who went along with a policy of trashing international law and creating the circumstances for him to create his private company and say, right, I'm taking over the world.
Yanis, but what about this fact of $1 billion? Each member will pay $1 billion to join. Now, this is unprecedented as far as international organizations go. Which international organizations require payment from member states?
And of course, well, Trump alone will be in charge of that money.
It's not at all unprecedented. It's how capitalism made its first flattering moves. Remember the East India Company, both the Dutch version and the British version? How did it happen? In the case of the British East India Company, while Shakespeare was writing a play somewhere in London, businessmen got together and they chipped in the equivalent of £1 billion or dollars or whatever each, to create that company. And that company, in the end, let us not forget that, was the first colonizer. They had 200,000 soldiers under their command. They took over East India. They took over Indonesia. And it was only later that states came and effectively nationalized colonialism. So we are going back many centuries. It's not... Maybe it's unprecedented given the narrative that we have been led to believe falsely that is now permanent over the last 60, 70 years. But essentially, Trump is, with the complicity of the Europeans, at least in terms of their deeds, if not their words, is trying to maintain American hegemony, the hegemony of a very tiny ruling class of the United States, not of the people of the United States, over the world.
It's very interesting that Commerce Secretary Howard Lutnick was heckled at the World Economic Forum dinner earlier this week with the European Central Bank President Christine Lagarde walking out. Lutnick had written in an opinion piece in the Financial Times earlier this week saying, we're not going to Davos to uphold the status quo. We're going to confront it head on. We are here at Davos to make one thing crystal clear. With President Trump, capitalism has a new sheriff in town. Yanis Varoufakis.
Well, it is interesting, isn't it? What he said to them was, we're not here to join your multilateral global order, which we Americans created in the first place, and you became beneficiaries of that. We're here to bury it. You know, Christine Lagarde walked out. But where did she walk towards? Back to Frankfurt, to the European Central Bank, which is steadfastly refusing to do anything in order to challenge the hegemony of the US dollar. Because, you know, here in Europe, we have manufactured a European Union and a monetary union for decades now, in a manner that it was always subservient to the United States, always acquiescent towards the dollar zone, towards the authority of the Federal Reserve. Never, never did the Europeans try to create. It's not that they tried and failed. They never wanted to create a sustainable, independent Europe. And now they are running around like a headless chicken, bleeding around, apoplexy, but without a plan. There is no European plan, for instance, for Ukraine. There's no. What happened when, President Trump ordered the Marines to go into Venezuela and abduct Maduro, whatever one thinks about Maduro? Did they protest the violation of international law? No, because they, again, like in the case of the Board of Peace in Gaza, they thought that this is for brown people, you know, for the people in the developing world. So this is, you know, as a European, I'm far more cross with our own leaders here who, you know, now protest, but it's too late.
Very interesting to see Jared Kushner giving center stage a PowerPoint presentation on what they would do with Gaza. You know, no Palestinians included here. And President Trump himself saying today, describing Gaza as a beautiful piece of property, said he is a real estate person at heart. As we begin to wrap up, your comments on what this means for Israel and Gaza and Netanyahu not coming to stand with his friend President Trump in Davos, concerned that he could be arrested for war crimes when he comes into Switzerland.
Well, that's the only silver lining, that something keeps him up at night. He's a war criminal and he should be kept up at night. But just to answer your question directly, what this Board of Peace plan for Gaza is the completion of the genocide. This is the logical limit of what Israel has been doing, to treat Gaza as a piece of real estate. Palestinians don't exist. They can only exist as servants. as in the same way that under South African apartheid, the blacks were tolerated only to the extent that they didn't choose where to live, that they were confined in bantustans, and they were beaten up the moment they asserted their right to exist and to breathe as human beings.
What you just heard was a portion of an interview Amy Goodman and Ermin Sheikh with Democracy Now! Conducted with Yanis Varoufakis, former finance minister of Greece and author of several books, about President Trump's so-called Board of Peace and threat to democratic world order. You can watch the entire interview at democracynow.org. You're listening to Arab Voices, a syndicated radio talk show on dozens of radio stations in the US and Europe since 2002. This is Saeed, executive producer and host of Arab Voices. Double Down News released a new segment on January 20th, 2026, titled The Palestinian Genocide, The Ultimate Evidence, by Chris Gunness, former chief spokesperson for the United Nations Relief and Works Agency for Palestinian Refugees in the Near East, UNRWA. Let's listen in.
Israel's sustained and systematically orchestrated assault on the Gaza Strip now has a name: the Palestinian Genocide. The newly published report by the UN's Independent Commission of Inquiry is unequivocal. Israel is engaged in genocide against the Palestinian people. From now on, the name of the world's newest genocide, the Palestinian Genocide, must be hammered into the discourse, boldly used, unapologetically and without fear, never forgotten. To do otherwise is genocide denial, an insult to the memory of the tens of thousands of Gazans who have been killed in what we now have a solid legal basis to call the Palestinian Genocide. The Commission gathered 16,000 pieces of evidence covering the period 7 October 2023 to 31 July 2025. It reached its landmark conclusion by investigating four of the five genocidal acts defined in the 1948 Genocide Convention. Israel was determined to have engaged in all four of these genocidal acts as a matter of state policy. On the first, killing members of the group, the Commission concluded that over 60,000 were killed, including nearly 10,000 women and over 18,000 children. On average, one child is killed every hour in Gaza. As of May 2025, Israeli intelligence officials listed 8,900 militants from Hamas and Palestinian Islamic Jihad as dead or possibly dead. Given that by this date, 53,000 Palestinians had been killed, Israel was making a public admission that 83% of its victims were civilians. Hundreds of journalists have been deliberately targeted. 13 every month on average have been killed in Israel's ongoing attempt to hide from the world the truth of the Palestinian genocide. As for those striving to mitigate its humanitarian impact, Gaza has become the deadliest place in the world for aid workers. 540 have been killed, including 373 UN staff, mainly UNRWA, and 167 NGO workers. And so I turn to the second category of acts that make up the Palestinian genocide, causing serious bodily or mental harm. As of July 30, 2025, according to the UN Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs, OCHA, the number of people injured in Gaza stood at 146,269. UNICEF says the total of children injured between 7 October 2023 and March 2025 is over 34,000. According to OCHA, Gaza is home to the largest cohort of child amputees in modern history, many deliberately targeted. The Commission found that Israel's use of lethal weapons had resulted in long-term, life-changing, debilitating injuries, including loss of limb, traumatic brain injuries, and damaged internal organs. The consequences of this have been compounded by the lack of functioning health infrastructure. 94% of Gaza's hospitals have been damaged or destroyed. There have been frequent reports of limbs being amputated without anaesthetics and women giving birth by caesarean section, unanaesthetized. According to the UN Commission, 1.9 million people have been displaced, most on average at least six times, some as many as 19 times. In June 2024, UNICEF stated that almost all of Gaza's 1.2 million children need mental health support. According to the Israeli authorities, more than 4,500 Palestinians in Gaza have been arrested, many transferred to facilities inside Israel in violation of the Geneva Conventions. The UN Commission received numerous reports of detainees, including children, being stripped, blindfolded, kicked, beaten, sexually assaulted, raped, and subjected to death threats and other forms of physical and psychological torture. I now turn to the third category of genocidal acts under the Genocide Convention, deliberately inflicting on the group conditions of life calculated to bring about its physical destruction in whole or in part. Almost immediately after the 7 October attack, the Israeli authorities announced a total siege on Gaza. In December 2023, Ocha described the humanitarian situation as apocalyptic. Ladies and gentlemen, the number of bombs dropped on Gaza is extraordinary, even in comparison with major world conflicts. One military source told the Commission, "Israel was dropping on Gaza in less than a week, what the United States dropped on Afghanistan in a year, in a much smaller, much more densely populated area." Credible comparisons have been made between Gaza and Hiroshima in relation to the amount of civilian infrastructure destroyed, about 70%. Israel has systematically destroyed Gaza's farmland. Ground troops have demolished greenhouses. Bulldozers have toppled orchards, ploughed out crops and crushed the soil. Israeli planes have sprayed herbicides over the fields. Before October 2023, about 40% of Gaza's land was farmed. Last month, the UN reported that just 1.5% of Gaza's agricultural land now remains accessible and undamaged. That's roughly 200 hectares to feed over 2 million people. Ecocide goes hand in hand with genocide. Perhaps the most shocking act in this third category of genocidal crime is deliberate starvation, as it involves such wide-scale complicity by the Israeli bureaucracy. In August this year, the UN officially declared starvation in Gaza. The UN-backed IPC, an internationally accepted system for assessing food security, estimated that a quarter of Gaza's 2.3 million people were suffering from famine. Starvation was reported in a fifth of all households in the Gaza governorate. According to the IPC, one in three children there were acutely malnourished to the point where at least two children in every 10,000 were dying every single day. Since the last IPC analysis, the number of children expected to be at risk of death from malnutrition by the end of June 2026 has tripled from 14,100 to 43,400. Think of it. Continued inaction and complicity by UN member states will allow nearly 45,000 children to starve to death in the next 9 months. The World Food Programme estimates that at least 15,500 metric tons of food per week is needed to meet just life-saving needs in Gaza. Between 1 and 15 September, Israel allowed the UN-led aid system to take in only 40% of that. Much of it was subsequently lost, as the Israeli army routinely forces UN convoys to travel along routes known for violent looting. 21 out of 50 malnutrition centres in northern Gaza, including 10 in Gaza City, have closed in recent weeks due to Israel's military offensive. Israel has destroyed over 85% of clean water facilities. Households survive on only 3 to 5 litres per person per day, well below survival thresholds. Preventable diseases have spiked sharply, including a threefold increase in diarrhoea and a more than doubling of jaundice. During Israel's aid blockade this spring, the World Health Organization reported stock zero for key items as nearly half of essential medicines ran out. The World Health Organization reports that only 44 trucks of health supplies have entered Gaza in September, shockingly below need. And given Israel's severe restrictions on the movement of people, there is a serious risk that more than 15,000 patients requiring emergency medical evacuation will be denied, with no capacity in Gaza to treat them. An estimated 70,000 litres of fuel per day are needed to keep hospitals, water systems, bakeries and coal chains functioning. Since the famine declaration, Israel has permitted only 41% of that requirement to enter Gaza, forcing constant triage by humanitarians and repeated shutdowns of life-saving services. As Gaza starves, just metres away, parked outside the starvation zone, on the other side of the fence which Israel built around Gaza, are thousands of trucks full of food. Not far away are the thriving restaurants and packed supermarkets of southern Israel. UNRWA estimates that there is enough food parked outside Gaza to feed the entire population for 3 months. Israel refuses to let them in. Instead, the Israelis continue to claim that the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation has prevented starvation, a claim that the IPC has shown categorically to be false. A recent GHF whistleblower described their operation as a death trap, where over 1,000 starving civilians have been deliberately targeted and killed. And so I turn to the final category of genocidal crimes investigated by the UN Commission, imposing measures intended to prevent births within the group. Attacks on healthcare facilities, including those offering sexual and reproductive healthcare services, have affected about 545,000 women and girls in Gaza who are of reproductive age. Direct attacks against the main maternity wards in Shifa Hospital and the Nasser Medical Complex in Khan Yunis rendered them inoperative for long periods of time. Facilities specifically designated as sexual and reproductive healthcare centres have been directly targeted or forced to end operations. The UN Commission investigated a shocking attack on Gaza's largest fertility centre, the Al-Basma Clinic in Gaza City, in December 2023. Around 4,000 embryos and 1,000 sperm samples and unfertilised eggs were destroyed. The Commission established that Israeli forces deliberately targeted the facility, launching a tank shell that directly hit the clinic and caused the explosion of 5 liquid nitrogen tanks, destroying all the reproductive material that was stored there for the future conception of thousands of Palestinian babies. Ladies and gentlemen, moving on to Israel's genocidal intent, the Commission established this beyond all reasonable doubt. Many senior Israeli officials are quoted by the Commission, including the President, the Prime Minister and the Defence Minister at the time of the October 2023 attack, boasting of their intentions to destroy the Palestinians in whole or in part. They incited and they gave orders for genocide, proudly and on the record, and numerous Israeli soldiers dutifully obeyed, triumphantly posting on social media as they destroyed whole apartment blocks, looted Palestinian homes, and gleefully violated international humanitarian law. The Israeli media spread the poison of dehumanisation, enabling, indeed popularising genocide, if opinion polls are to be believed. But the recently published comments by Israel's finance minister, Bezalel Smotrich, have revealed something even more disturbing: the commercialisation of genocide. Mr. Smotrich has said on the record, in a public forum, and I quote in unofficial translation, "There is a business plan, a real estate bonanza. It really pays off. We have started negotiations with the Americans. We have paid a lot of money for this war, but we need to decide how we make back a percentage on the land marketing. We've done the demolition phase, which is the first phase of urban renewal." End quote. As Israel's vision of a settler-based Riviera in Gaza comes into focus, we are seeing the commercialization not just of genocide, but of war crimes, crimes against humanity, apartheid, aggression and ethnic cleansing. And with Israel's publicly stated intention of massively expanding illegal Jewish settlements and taking complete control of the West Bank, including East Jerusalem, we may be seeing the commercialization of illegal annexation. Ladies and gentlemen, the conclusion that Israel is committing genocide reinforces pre-existing third state obligations to end the Palestinian genocide and punish its perpetrators. As the UN Commission concluded, the prohibition on genocide is a peremptory norm of international law, a legal obligation that is accepted and recognised by the international community of states, from which no derogation is permitted. In other words, all UN member states have an obligation to prevent and also to punish genocide. The only question is how. Turkey led by example, imposing an arms and trade embargo on Israel. Others too are getting on the right side of international law. If Mr. Netanyahu and his former defence minister, Yoav Gallant, arrive in the territory of any of the 123 member states of the International Criminal Court or overfly their airspace, they must be arrested and handed over to The Hague in accordance with ICC arrest warrants and in conformity with treaty obligations. Sanctions must also be imposed in support of the International Court of Justice and the General Assembly's overwhelming demand that Israel end its illegal presence in Palestine, the deadline for which passed just days ago. To be clear, there is now a double imperative, a twin justification to impose sanctions on Israel. Firstly, to end the Israeli occupation of Palestine, and secondly, to prevent and punish genocide. To this end, plans are afoot in the General Assembly to impose a full range of punitive sanctions: trade, military, diplomatic, cultural, sporting, academic, and more. This is not a choice for member states, it is a legal obligation. And in the face of government inaction, the people are mobilising, not just courageous students, dock workers across Europe are pointing the way forward, threatening to shut down the European shipping industry. Global direct action, campaigns of civil disobedience and industrial disruption will escalate if governments continue with their illegal support for the ongoing Palestinian genocide. Ladies and gentlemen, the UN Commission report is an important legal milestone on the Palestinians' long road to justice, freedom, self-determination, dignity and peace. It gives those who have long argued that Israel is committing genocide a solid basis in fact and legal analysis. We must not delay action, as some have argued, until the International Court of Justice makes its determination on genocide. That could take years. Meanwhile, there is an obligation to end genocide and to punish its perpetrators. The greatest cruelties in the annals of man's inhumanity to man are given names: the Warsaw Ghetto, the Tiananmen Square Massacre, the Rwanda Genocide, to name but three. And though uniquely different, we now have the Palestinian Genocide. Henceforth, it must become an undeniable and constantly referenced touchstone in the global discourse. It must become a rallying point for solidarity with the Palestinian people and a springboard for robust international action. Thank you. Double Down News brands itself as the future of journalism, and I have to say, the more I consume media stuff, the more I think they really are the future of journalism. They dare to say things which other people don't. They dare to challenge the narrative, the orthodoxy that's pervaded by many of mainstream media. And I think for that reason alone, amongst many others, I think they're really worthy of your support. So join the future of journalism. Support Double Down News on Patreon.
That was Chris Gunness, former chief spokesperson for UNRWA, via Double Down News. More about Double Down News is at doubledown.news. You've been listening to Arab Voices, a syndicated radio talk show on dozens of radio stations in the US and Europe since 2002. Our shows are archived online and you can listen to them by visiting arabvoices.net. And that does it for the show today. Thanks for listening. This is Saeed, executive producer and host of Arab Voices. Until we meet next week, peace on earth.